besides what I've just talked about, I can't think of anything that's happened this week. Besides, I work two over 14-hour days and then an over 10-hour day. Let me show you what I worked. This is what I worked. Oh, it was 11 and a half hours yesterday.
You really just said, I'm going to do all the work in 3 days and be done.
Correct.
That's what I did.
I respect it.
Okay, I'll go first because whenever I was doing the research, I was really excited. And then this week was stressful, so I literally forgot what I had even done. But today I'm covering the Omni Park Hotel, which, like, literally I don't think I've ever heard of.
So you're an Parker? Is it that? Or is it Park?
Parker. I can't read.
Because you have Parker the rest of the way down, too.
Yeah, I just realized that. The Omni Parker Hotel, which is, like, a really famous hotel that I had...
Never.
I think I've heard of the name before, but...
Yeah, but I can't tell if I'm just, like, know anything like about that Omniplex...
Yeah.
Thing that is on
I don't
some
know.
Video thing.
But anyway, I got my information from Wikipedia, historyofmassachusetts.org, omnihotels.com, historichotels.org, and ghostcitytours.com. So, the original Parker House Hotel was built in 1855 by Harvey D. Parker. He founded it, but they didn't... I don't know who, like, actually constructed it. Normally, there's some kind of architect, but I couldn't really find that. It opened on October 8th, 1855... And then additions and alterations were already being made to this hotel within the first 5 years of it being open. So I think that just means it was, like, booming right off of the bat.
Place.
It was home to the Saturday Club, which had famous poets, essayists, and other scholarly people who were members of this Saturday Club. It's not like a restaurant or something. It's like...
Yeah, it's like those gentlemen's clubs that were really popular back in the day.
Ralph Waddle... Waldo... Waddle... Waldo Emerson and some other big name people were a part of it, which, like, they said a whole bunch of people, but he's the only name I recognize. Charles Dickens stayed here for 5 months in 1867 to 1868 in his own apartments, and he first recited and performed a Christmas carol for the Saturday Club at the Parker House. The hotel has kept the door to his guest room and the mirror he used for rehearsals. So those are somewhere in the hotel still. Mm-hmm. The Parker Hotel was the first to introduce Americans to the European plan. Before this, most American hotels included meals in the cost of your room and only offered it at set times. But the Parker House charged for the rooms only, and then you could pay for meals separately, and you could order it whenever. So I'm guessing in, like, a room service kind of situation.
So they introduced room service.
Basically. But they called it the European plan, so. John Wilkes Booth stayed at the Parker Hotel from April 5th to the 6th in 1865, just 8 days before the assassination of Lincoln.
Oh my goodness.
And they were saying something about him visiting his brother and this and the other thing, and I was like, this is not a story about John Wilkes Booth. So between 1866 and 1925, the hotel grew and added more stories and other additions, and it eventually grew to be over 41,400 square feet of land. So it's a pretty big hotel. The Parker House also created Massachusetts state dessert, the Boston cream pie.
I love it when famous, like, foods are always, they're always from hotels. It's
I know.
The funniest thing to me.
They also invented the Parker House roll and coined the word scrod, which is a term used for the freshest, finest, and youngest whitefish of the day.
Super fresh cod. Scrod.
I think it's scrod. I don't know. But anyway, so the Boston cream pie was originally called chocolate cream pie or Parker House chocolate cream pie. It was reportedly invented by French pastry chef M. Sanzian. The original had more French details, like a rum glaze brushed onto the cake layers and silvered almonds around the sides. So it used to be fancier than we Americanized it. But I mean, Boston cream pie is delicious, so I don't need almonds or rum in it, personally. As for the rolls, a German baker invented those, and it was said that an angry baker threw a tray of unfinished rolls in the oven after having an argument with a hotel guest, and then when he took them out, they were puffy on the inside and crispy and buttery on the outside with a distinct folded shape. The original roll recipe was actually kept secret until 1933 when President Franklin Roosevelt requested that they be served at a White House dinner. Which I haven't heard before. Of them, but I have seen them now that you're looking at them. But I think that's funny.
They're not usually like the classic shape.
I like that the chef was the pastry chef was getting into an argument with the hotel guest because that's me. Jacques Offenbach stayed at the hotel in 1876 and, inspired by the roles, sang a song to his friend as a joke. And he then went on to use it as a theme in his opera, The Tales of Hotman. Or Hotman? I don't know what it is. I just thought that was funny that you're singing about the roles. Anyway, that must be really good. I mean, I love a good role. Don't even get me started. Anyway, I'm hungry.
I really want rolls, not bad.
So, after Harvey Parker died on May 31st, 1884, the hotel was passed to his partners, Edward O. Punkard? And Joseph H. Beckman, until 1891, when Joseph Reed Whipple took over. To give their guests the freshest and finest food, he established his own 2,500-acre dairy farm in New Boston, New Hampshire. He also helped build a railroad depot in New Boston and connected it to existing main lines to help deliver quickly to the hotel. So it's almost like what's the mansion that I covered? Where they just built everything on property because it was such a big thing to do, and then they built the railroad tracks to the house.
We've covered a few like that recently.
So the original Parker House building and additions were demolished in the mid-1920s and replaced in 1927 with a modern building, and that is what still stands there today. That hasn't been torn down or burnt down. Mm-hmm. Many times. Mm-hmm. But I gotta remember what hotel that was. It just kept burning down. They just kept rebuilding. One wing of the 19th century hotel stayed up until the new building was completed in 1927, which helped them to claim the title of America's oldest operating hotel. The Omni Parker House Bar, The Last Hurrah, was named for Edwin O'Connor's 1956 novel. Some people might know that I don't, but I kept it in. John F. Kennedy announced his candidacy for Congress at the Parker House in 1946 and also held his bachelor party in the hotel's press room in 1953. He also proposed to Jackie at table 40 in Parker's restaurant inside the hotel.
That makes sense.
In 1983 is when the Omni name was, like, introduced. To be the mm-hmm. Omni Parker. It was a bunch of, like, changing hands and companies and whatever. The hotel currently has 551 rooms and suites. In 2009, AAA named the hotel one of the top 10 historic U.S. hotels. It is a member of the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Historic Hotels of America program. That is, like, the longest name for an association. The hotel is still the longest continuously operating hotel in the U.S., even with the pandemic, because the staff still maintained the property and responded to guests for future reservations. They also still marketed the original Boston cream pie, so they were, like, selling mm-hmm. those mm-hmm. During COVID, too. Parker's restaurant is older than the hotel by 22 years. Harvey D. Parker, who was then a coachman, for a Watertown woman, used to visit a diner in a cellar cafe when he was in Boston. In 1832, Parker bought the cafe for $432.
Excuse me?
And renamed it to the Parker's Restaurant. The restaurant soon became famous for its food and great service and was popular with businessmen, lawyers, and newspapermen. And in 1847, Parker gained a business partner, John F. Mills, and then by 1854, the two purchased a former mansion, which they renovated into the hotel. Mm. I would love to buy a restaurant for $432.
Yeah.
A typical menu at the restaurant would have things, back in the day, would have things like mock turtle soup, boiled turkey and oyster sauce, and ham in champagne. I don't know what that is, but none of that sounds appetizing. So here's some fun facts. Ho Chi Minh worked as a baker at the hotel from 1912 to 1913.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
I hope she covers that.
Malcolm X was a busboy at the hotel in the 1940s. Emeril, how do you say his last name?
Lagasse?
Because I know Dad loves that guy, but mm-hmm. I just know Emeril. Mm-hmm. He was a sous chef in the Parker Kitchens from 1979 to 1981. For over 150 years, the Parker House has been part of poetry and other writings. It is mentioned in Death of a Salesman, Stephen King's short story, 1408, and is allegedly based on room 303 of the Parker House. Mark Twain stayed at the Parker House in room 168. Nobody says that about hotel rooms. 168. He called the hotel, quote, pretty near heaven. So, I mean, obviously, like, you're seeing all the famous people that are going, like, here it's a higher end. Like, it's been a higher end place since it started, it seems like. The hotel is also mentioned in the secret history, The Boston Girl, and the 2011 Grammy Award-winning Parker Quartet, who was founded and based in Boston. That band is named after the hotel. On to the hauntings. So, longtime Omni Parker House bellman John Brehm, in a 1992 Boston Globe interview, said, quote, I first heard about the ghost of Harvey Parker when I began working here in 1941. They used to say he roamed the halls on the 10th floor annex. There were many stories, but one in particular happened around 1950. An elderly woman guest insisted she saw an apparition outside room 1078. At first, it was a misty apparition in the air, then it turned toward her. She said it was a heavy-set older man with a black mustache. He just looked at her and then faded away. They checked it out, but reportedly they could find nothing. So guests reported that at the same time on two consecutive mornings. This is a different story. But they reported that at the same time on two consecutive mornings, there were people whispering outside her doorway. Every time she opened the door, there was no one there. Her room was at the end of the hallway, so there wasn't really any way for you to, like, sprint off without, you know, being seen when she opened the door. She said they were friendly voices and sounded like they had just come back from a glorious evening.
Well, that's nice.
Security has been called to room 1040 for noise complaints on multiple occasions. Every time they have gone to check, they have found the room empty. Which I don't know what kind of noise complaints, like someone below them says there's someone stomping upstairs, or like they're screaming or music. Party noises. I don't know what, but elevator 1 frequently goes to the 3rd floor, which was the floor where Charles Dickens stayed, without there being any button pressed or guests in the elevator. And people think like Charles Dickens could be a ghost here since he really liked it. Mm-hmm. Or was that Mark Twain? No, it was Mark Twain. But I don't know. But anyway, but yeah, so there was a longtime resident who stayed in room 303. He was known to drink lots of whiskey and smoke foul cigars. Guests sometimes complain about the smell of whiskey and cigars even after the room had been cleaned. Which isn't, that's just icky. An icky, like, what you bring back as a ghost is your stench. That's bad. It's not a nice, that's foul.
It's not the pretty perfume you
wore. Yeah. So, guests have also heard disembodied laughter in that room, which, like, you know it's got to be, like, his ghost breath that is smelling up the room. He's, like, laughing and just stinks. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one night, a security guard said he saw the shadow of a man on the wall in the Bosworth section of the hotel, which is the oldest section of the hotel. When he stepped to the side to let the man pass, there was no one there. He later said it was strange because the shadow was wearing a stovepipe hat. And this was, like, in recent times. That is like, weird. It wasn't, like, in the olden times. Yeah. Guests have seen numerous apparitions on the 9th and 10th floors that aimlessly walk the corridors. In a room on the 10th floor, people have reported the sound of a rocking chair that kept them up all night, but there are no rocking chairs anywhere in the hotel, which I don't like that one. Rocking chairs are just, it's like rocking chairs and wheelchairs are the creepiest. Mm-hmm. Corey, you can say something. I don't know why you're sitting there so silent this whole time. Corey's here, everybody. If you've been listening since the beginning,
Corey's back.
You'd know who he is.
I think I'm still stuck on the turtle soup and champagne and ham.
Ham and champagne?
Oh, yeah, that was right. I was like, well, you know, that's not my idea of
a nice
room service.
Please don't bring that. Don't bring that to my room. That whole Boston cream pie, please.
Believe.
Bring that right on up.
Actually, bring the oven up.
Cook them in my room. Where was it? Oh, bellmen have reported bright orbs of light floating down the corridor on the 10th floor and then just disappearing. Mm-hmm. And there was one time a mother and daughter were staying the night in room 1012. The daughter woke up in the early morning and saw a man dressed in period clothing, probably from, like, the later 1800s, standing at the end of her bed. He had a large grin on his face, and she smiled back, and he disappeared. When she went down to breakfast that morning, she saw a portrait of the man she had seen in her room. The portrait was of Harvey Parker. And that's the story of the Omni Parker Hotel.
I hate that so much.
Well, she said it wasn't, like, a creepy smile. She said, like, it was, like, a smile of, like, I hope you're enjoying your stay. You know, like...
Oh, okay.
Not, like...
Just, like, ah.
Good morning. Like, no, it wasn't like that. It was, like...
Well, that's good.
Everything basically seems to be, like, welcoming... at this hotel, like the lady hearing the nice voices outside of her door, and so
malevolence.
But that one I really, I just liked the history the most. The ghosts were good too, but the history's fun. Boston cream pie, delish.
Okay, well, that's my story now.
Go for it.
Okay, so I didn't have a good title for mine because I didn't know if I should name it after the murderer or the victim.
Yeah, sometimes I just include both of them, or sometimes I just start telling it, and then you just hear all the names.
Yeah, you'll hear all the names. The thing I made to remember which one it was, because that's usually what my title's for, is for me more than anything else. It's just The Milkman in the Snow.
Okay.
My sources are...
That could go a lot of different ways here.
Yeah. The Daily Item, which is a newspaper, the Boston Globe, newspaper, and then Murder by Gaslight, which is somebody's like personal blog, and they do a good job. I want to look at their blog for like other things in the future.
So
on January 4th, 1887, two boys were walking down the road near Lexington, Massachusetts, when they came across a bloody shirt on top of a wall that ran along the road. So they stopped and looked around, because that's what you do when you find a bloody shirt on the side of the wall. And on the other side of the wall, they discovered a bundle of clothing. The bundle included underclothes, like underpants, undershirt, socks, his pants, overcoat, I think a hat, and then gloves. Just literally everything but the shirt, because the shirt is on the wall. everything's covered in blood, too. The boys brought the clothes into town, and the police determined that the murder most likely happened in the last 48 hours.
They already assume it's just a murder right off the bat.
Well, that's a lot of bloody clothes that are in a really weird spot.
Some people get nosebleeds.
You know, I think they'd be dead. They'd be a body by then.
I don't know.
A lot of blood.
Well, we don't know how much blood it actually was. And back then, I don't think they would know exactly how much blood you have to lose to be fully dead.
To fall over.
There's a lot there's a lot of blood in this story. It's all the blood.
Okay, okay.
It's the whole body's worth of blood.
Well, yeah, but we're just talking about the clothing so far.
There's more blood later.
Unless it's, like, all fully soaked through, then that's more cause for concern.
I don't think it's necessarily fully soaked through. I think it's notable, though. So, the next day, a local farmer, L.I. Brooks, discovered a bloody patch of snow in the middle of which he saw what he thought at the time was a large snowball. It was not, in fact, a snowball, but rather the severed head of a man sitting in the middle of the bloody patch.
Why would he think it's a snowball?
It was covered in snow.
Winter. Did it, like, roll down the hill?
Yeah, I was like, snow? Well, at first I'm thinking, oh my god, what an amazing... Somebody rolled a dead body into a giant snowball, is what I was thinking first. And I was like
the head's covered in snow.
That's less cool.
They didn't think that one through.
The head, in addition to be missing, its body also had two or three deep gashes on the left side, enough to, like, basically disfigure the face.
Mm-hmm.
And about 4 feet from the head, Brooks found a severed arm that he assumed belonged to the same man.
Yeah. Who else should it be?
So after he discovered the arm...
Cut his own arm off.
he left the body parts where they lie and hurried back to town to inform the authorities. I don't, he would have gone because of the head too, but I think he found the arm as he was like turning to leave. It wasn't like.
Oh, now that there's two pieces of a body, I guess I can about alert it. The authorities.
I wasn't sure before if foul play
happened. Some people, I mean, if chickens can run around with their head cut off, maybe the man is okay.
So by the end of the day, a search party had been sent out, and most of the man's naked body had been found. Most of it was half hidden in a bush in a gully about a mile from where the head had been discovered.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how much of it was intact together, but by the end of the day, they had found everything but the guy's right leg. So I don't know if like all the other limbs were also chopped off, or if just some of them were chopped off. I think most of them were probably chopped off.
He's pretty dismembered, is what it seems like.
Authorities began inquiring in the neighboring towns to attempt to identify the dead man. We got to figure that out first before we can figure out who did it. A Mr. L.B. Pillsbury, who ran a boarding house in Somerville, suspected that the deceased was one of his boarders, George A. Codman, as a description of his clothes that had been published in the newspaper matched what Codman wore. Specifically, a pair of gloves that had been found in the bundle that had been mended by Codman's girlfriend, Jenny Fisher, with, like, a specific bed ticking. I assume that means, like...
stitching?
No, like, cloth. That a bed is made of, or, like, a sheet.
Yeah.
I don't know what specifically ticking is, but I assume it's something that's not usually clothes. So that helped them figure out who it was, and they called in Codman's brother, and he was able to identify, despite the state of the remains, that was, in fact, his brother.
Mm-hmm.
George Codman was 22 years old. He was working as a milkman and made regular deliveries in Cambridge and Boston. His route consisted of him, and this was like, his daily routine was very consistent. He left the house at 2 a.m. to start his rounds and returned home by 1 p.m. So he was easily noticed as missing at 2 p.m. on mm-hmm. May 1st. So it was like, oh, he's supposed to be back by now. Because he always is. Like, always. Codman was described as hardworking and painstaking, and always paid his bills on time. When he wasn't working as a milkman, he spent most of his spare time cleaning the stable where he rented a stall, and I don't know if that was payment for the stall or if that was a side hustle, like if he also did this as a job. That November, Mrs. Osgood, who owned the stables where Codman worked, said he was working too hard and needed a break, and Codman said that he would like to visit his his mother in New Hampshire for Thanksgiving, but was just too busy. He hire help, so he did. Codman hired James E. Nowlin, 17-year-old, local kid. So around 2 p.m. May 1st, Nowlin walked into Pillsbury's boarding house and said, Codman will not be home for dinner. This is in quotes, Codman will not be home for dinner. He is going away and sent me to get his coat and box of change. Mrs. Pillsbury let him into Codman's room because he recognized him as hired help.
Yeah.
Like, that's not the most ridiculous thing. Nowlin left with the coat, the box, and then he also emptied out Codman's wallet, taking a total of $295, which is around $9,534. Today, so that's like a good chunk to
scoodle that's with. His like little savings at home.
When questioned by the authorities, Nowlin said that at 11 a.m. on May 1st, he had seen Codman sitting in his sleigh with a stranger when he informed Nowlin that he would be leaving for an indefinite period of time, and that Nowlin was to take charge of the business, so both
something's
the stable
fishy.
Work and the milkman business. So the authorities questioned Nowlin a second time after learning of his visit to the boarding house, because like they obviously questioned him the first time.
Yeah,
he's a close person to the victim. So they found out he went to the boarding house, and by this time they'd also found a bloodstained axe and a butcher knife in the stables, as well as blood on the floor.
Oh.
A lot of blood everywhere. So they're like, okay, that's also suspicious, because Nowlin works in the stables.
I love the typo, blood on the flood.
During the second questioning, Nowlin said that he had witnessed the murder, and the two men, Tom Nevins and Mike Sweeney were responsible. Okay. There's a bit of a problem, though, because Sweeney was already in custody for something else at the time of the murder. So he definitely didn't do it. And Nevis had an airtight alibi, like, just unquestionable. Yeah.
Like, he was at work with everybody around him the whole time. Sorry, I was in Florida. Yeah. Actually, I was getting away from the cold.
I was, like, all the way away. I don't know what it was, but...
Yeah.
More of the stories couldn't be him. So authorities questioned Nellen a third time after they went and got these alibis for these other two individuals. And Nellen confessed. He said, quote, "Well, I might as well die for it. I did it alone. Codman came in and stood with his back to me. I reached for the knife, then cut his throat. Codman cried, 'Don't,' and followed me to the ice chest where he fell dead."
Oh my gosh.
Nellen then cut up the body with the axe and to make transportation easier, is what he said. using Codman's own sleigh to drive it out of town and dispose the parts in various locations. He even told the police where to find the missing leg. Like, he did it. Like,
it's obviously.
Oh, yeah, the leg's over there. He missed it.
He didn't keep it for a trophy?
No, he didn't. I'm sorry.
The trophy was his money.
The whole right leg.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping he would take it with him.
No, and then there's something like a dog.
So the motive.
I mean, it was the winter time. It was snowing. He may have needed to eat something.
He has a job.
Well, he just took his money, too. So if he was really not hungry, he had $10,000.
Yeah, that's true. Well,
nearly.
So the motive that was, like, the official motive in, like, both the court case and all the papers was theft. Because it was said that Codman was expecting a payment of $600 from a client. And that's $600 then money.
Yeah.
Which I forgot to translate. But if $295 is almost $10,000, $600 is a pretty penny.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he hadn't paid that yet, though, so he didn't get it all. A little thing that was left out of all these official proceedings is that Codman's face and genitals had been mutilated.
Oh.
Which is not normal when robbery alone is the motivation. So I'm thinking more it was probably a combined thing. Well, I can get the money out of it, and then also he has a beef for whatever reason. So apparently, when Nellen was first hired, Codman had him driving the milk route. Like, that was the thing he was helping with. He drove the milk route, and then Codman took care of the stables. But Nellen was taking too long, spending a notable amount of time parked outside of the house of a dashing young widow. So Codman switched him off of that route and into the stables, because only one thing you do when you're spending that much time outside of the house of a dashing young widow.
Yeah.
And it said that Nellen became angry when he saw that Codman was parked out of the same house.
Dun, dun, dun.
So there might have been some love, scorn, fooling around, motivation to it, too. So this, like, this fooling around bit and the genital mutilation were never included in, like, the court case by either side. The prosecution specifically avoided it. No, just in the trial.
Hmm.
Because they didn't want to do anything to suggest mental imbalance.
Fair enough. That means you don't. Yeah, then you can't go for death penalty, basically.
And that, like, robbery was, because it was a decent enough amount of money to make it, you can convince a jury of it.
Yeah.
So, what is weird, though, is that the other side, like, the defense didn't include any of that because it could have helped him, especially
since... But back then, it's like, I don't know if you had to share all the same documents.
I don't know either.
I really don't know about that.
You didn't have to share it across the board.
So they might not have even
known. It's like the defense had to do their own research, and if they didn't do it well enough, they wouldn't know.
I don't know.
But they would have known about the genital mutilation. That would have been an obvious part, I think. Anyway, Nellen did, however, claim mental illness on both sides of his family as, like, part of his defense.
Doesn't count. Everybody
has
it.
That his father hanged himself in a Canadian prison, and a number of his mother's side of the family had been institutionalized because he was trying to play that route, but his defense was doing nothing for that. Nellen's immediate family believed him to be insane.
What's anybody's proof of that? You know, like, what did he do in his childhood? Because he's only 17. He's also 17. He's
a kid.
And this sounds like a 17-year-old murder, you know, does. Because he's not smart. Like, this he's is clearly not. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. It doesn't seem like he's mm-hmm. full-on mentally ill.
Yeah.
If he were, you wouldn't have even taken the money.
He's just
you would have just snapped. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't mm-hmm. have taken the money. You wouldn't have thought to do that part. So, none of the insanity plea convinced the jury, and he was found guilty of first-degree murder on July 6th, 1887. He was given the death penalty by way of hanging, and on January 20th, 1888, Nallen was hanged. His last words were, when a thing of this kind is done, there is no one doing it. God knows in my heart, God knows in my heart and soul, I am sorry. If I had known as much about the Bible then as I do now, this thing never would have happened, which really leans itself to that he was just immature, dumb.
Yes.
So yeah, that's the,
I've never heard of that one.
No, well, when it's straight out of the old-timey newspapers and there's only one Google, like, it only, no Wikipedia page, only comes up in this guy's blog, and it doesn't come up directly in his blog. It's, like, a different thing that connects it back to Weird. His blog. Like, isn't in the immediate Google
search. I just love old-timey stories. Mm-hmm. They're just so interesting.
It's fun when there's nothing on them already.
Yeah. They're especially interesting because compared to now, everybody now is like, I'm crazy. That's why mm-hmm. I did it. Not just because I'm a terrible, hateful person. But like back then, I'm crazy. Because everybody knows you can pull that. Mm-hmm. Back then, they were like, well, if I get out of this, I don't want everybody to think I'm crazy.
Yeah, because that's bad.
Like, exactly.
You can't heal from that back then.
But,
no. And people really were just murdering for money often back then, so.
Anyway. Try not to kill anybody and don't mess with Ouija boards. Bye.